podcast devoted to the 69th best show of the 21st century. One of your hosts, as always, Ryan Swen, joined by...
I'm Ian.
We're here potentially before a very momentous day for me. There is a good chance, or I wouldn't say a good chance, but there is a chance that on Sunday I will be seen in an intimate concert, Kiefer Sutherland.
I was gonna ask you what the status report on that was.
Well, the tickets are still sold out. They say that there may be tickets at the door, so I will be going to standby for my first concert, which will be for Kiefer Sutherland. So we'll see about that. I cannot promise that I'll get in.
Did you just say your first concert?
Well, my first non-classical or jazz concert, I think.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah, I don't know. I just never had the... Well, I don't know. You could maybe count the K-pop concert that my sister dragged me to at one point.
Oh, I feel like...
That might count.
Yeah, I feel like that... I mean, those are it depends on the group.
It was like a convention.
It's like a big production, right?
Yeah, it was actually a bunch of... A bunch of groups. I think it's called SM Town or something.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Wow, I had no idea.
This was 15 years ago, which is wild to think about. But yeah, if you don't count that, the first one I've gone to of my own volition, will be, if this goes through, an acoustic set with Kiefer Sutherland.
That's incredible. I'm very bummed that I can't join you, but. You know, you're doing the most for this podcast right now.
I don't know. We'll see.
I've been watching. I've been sporadically watching another modern LA canon television show, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and it is a show that makes a lot out of just simply moving around LA. So unlike 24, which makes everything seem like magic.
Yes.
So you have my solidarity as you set out to do this. Man, I hope you get in. That'll be such a great episode.
Yeah.
If you get in.
I will absolutely, if I can talk to Kiefer, I will mention the podcast.
That's incredible. Yeah. This would be the first episode that he would listen to as well.
Oh goodness. That's kind of...
I remembered this time. We're covering the hours from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m.
Yes, definitely. Actually, before that, we should also briefly mention the clip of the contractor. I feel like Kiefer's voice is higher pitched than he is as Jack Bauer in that. He's purposely speaking in a sort of higher register. I couldn't quite figure out the purpose, but... It was kind of weird, especially with that. Even though he has the goatee, it's also the mustache is prominent enough that it's almost a villain's, a twirling villain's mustache.
Yeah, you know, I think I don't know a lot about the film, and decontextualized, it's kind of hard to tell. But I think he is maybe a little bit of a villainous character.
Probably.
With that beard and everything. Yeah, something about, he has the signature kind of hoarse whisper, of course, and then the kind of shouting Jack Bauer. But yeah, he's in kind of a higher register there. Maybe a little more assured and authoritative in some ways. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it simply has to do with playing off of Chris Pine, who also has kind of a deeper tone.
Yeah, I feel like maybe it's just to heighten the contrast between them. This sort of former military guy that's gone a bit soft or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
That'll be fun to see I hope that Kiefer, we'll see it eventually probably, but I hope that Kiefer gets some good action.
Yeah. I feel like for them to put out that promo clip that features him pretty prominently, I feel like they're playing it up a little bit. I'm excited for that one. And then we got that FDR series coming up at some point soon too.
But actually, that sort of ties in pretty well to at least the first episode of these two episodes, which I think for the first time it actually has, since maybe the first episode of this of the series, it has him actually delegating in a way that actually is actually really fun to watch. Just him sort of organizing with all these different crew members. And yeah, I feel like even more than past episodes, these two episodes, with some exceptions within the actual episode, actual storylines themselves, are really divided into the good storylines and the bad storylines. I mean, it's not quite shocking because we've certainly had this, these sort of dichotomies before, but I feel like it's even more heightened than usual just because of how many poor decisions are being made in the Terry and Kim storylines.
Yeah, I would be remiss not to reiterate that the amnesia plot comes directly from Stephen Hopkins' own experience with temporary amnesia. And in fact, he put a great deal of time into, depicting this accurately based at least on his own experience. And you can really, that care is in every frame.
I also have to reiterate my Mulholland Drive comparison, because you have this, she is taken to a restaurant, this random restaurant that has these memories, these vivid memories of. And also, I feel like, especially in that first scene with like the restaurant owner, like he sort of almost drifts in a similar way to like one of the waitresses there, like, just in a vaguely Lynchian manner. It's just like this very, I think I had sort of a feeling that this would probably not work for me. Maybe it's a similar sort of sense memory as, from when I was first watching it, compared to how Terry's sense memory is operating in these episodes, but it's rough so far.
It's difficult because it's like such a, it's just kind of a dead end that they're kind of stuck in. I mean, by the end of episode 18, it's like we've gone through three episodes of this rigmarole to just revert to, like, to get back to where things were at the midseason point, right? But what I do find interesting, because you mentioned, talking about Kiefer at the start and, like, Jack kind of, like, delegating and stuff. Episode 17 is almost like, it's something that's so interesting about the show, because episode 17 is, like, the first time we really see, like, what a normal day at CTU might be like. Like, Jack's running an op. He's like trying to get things to get like everything up until this point has been everybody kind of on their heels, just reacting to things.
Yeah.
And this is the first time where it's like, oh, this is what his job is. This is what he does. We also get to see like George Mason being boss too, which is really great. He's actually, he's not a bad boss.
He's like, really good.
He knows what he's doing. it's such an interesting dichotomy. Like, the dichotomy between him and Jack just continues to become more fascinating to me, because aside from, the maybe strategic withholding of information that we can question the ethics of, George Mason seems like a guy who absolutely should and could be in charge of these people.
Yeah, like he's asking Tony to pass on Jack's sort of queries to him. Like, you just have him, like, talking down the insane caricature, disgruntled field agent. even though our man in New Orleans has died, his vibe is still present. In this episode.
it's great. I had a question for you, which is that in episode 17, I sort of felt like that was the first episode where the writers started laying the track for the revelation of Nina being the mole. I wondered if you felt the same way.
Oh, in what sense?
I really screwed myself on the notes here because I didn't put anything specific. But there's a moment, I think it has to do with, I think it has something to do with they're talking about, like, the safe house and all of that, and she is maybe dissuading Jack from checking in, or in a way that I guess could be both ways, which is like, well, maybe it's just a narrative convenience because this is happening at a time when we know things have gone south over there, right? And so Jack can't check in yet because he needs to do this thing, but it did feel like there was a little bit of like maybe a meaningful kind of linger on her in this interaction. I think it's about midway through the episode. Yeah, I just felt like it was the first time I really felt like, oh, maybe they've like come across this idea and they're starting to maybe toy with it, because it's also something that feels like it could just be kind of a non sequitur. Like you could just leave it behind if she wasn't, and it wouldn't make a difference. But yeah, episode 17 and 18 begin to feel like maybe they've like decided this is the person.
It's possible. I mean, I didn't really notice it myself, but like I could, it's definitely you saying the episodes again, like it is really weird to think that we're only 6 episodes away from the end.
Yeah,
like it's I mean, like I would think that if ever they were going to decide on it, it would probably not be in the last 4 episodes. So like this definitely seems like the time that they would probably think about that, but yeah, I'm not sure. And I would also say, just because of all the sort of haphazard stuff that's happening, like it's I don't know if I would necessarily trust them to be ironclad set on their end game.
That's fair. They got a lot of irons in the fire here.
Yeah, they have. Well, but they're also sort of like retrieving irons in a way that doesn't really work as well. Like you have I mean, like the Terry stuff is, you know, not working for me, but I think that even it's actually the Kim stuff is actually a lot worse.
It's awful. My note says Kim/Rick plot, just awful, torturous.
Yeah, like it's also going back to the sort of moralizing well, and a like the teen moralizing well that's really, yeah, really egregious. First of all, like the idea of Kim thinking that Rick is smart, which is demonstrably not not apparent.
You know, I feel like that's kind of there to soften. Like if you say someone is funny by itself, that's kind of a backhanded compliment. You have to add something to it. And so she says smart and, you know,
also good looking.
Yeah. Rick is hot. I get that. And that's maybe why the other two compliments come tumbling out. he's hot in a very 2002 kind of way.
Yeah, you know? that's true.
I feel like, you know, they were looking for an actor who could be on the cover of like a teen magazine, and they found the face. Open. Yeah,
he's got
yeah,
his shirt
he's
open for the entire episode. It's ridiculous.
But he's like obviously sickly because, you know, he's been shot and not been tended to. So it's like sort of a, in some ways, kind of anticipating the sort of Pete Davidson look. You know?
And you have his girlfriend does know that his arm is injured, but she doesn't see, like, she thought he like cut it open on a fence, even though like there's a bullet hole through his arm.
Yeah, I don't know, because I don't think we ever get a scene.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever get a scene where he like arrives home.
Yeah.
I think the first scene we see is like he's already there and has a shirt on and is, or at least has some kind of wrapping around the wound.
Mm-hmm. It's also funny thinking about like him taking a bus to Echo Park, because that was one of the places I used to go on the bus when I was like, because they used to have the Echo Park Film Center there. And so it was funny to think of him going, and it's actually close enough like by taxi that it would probably not take too long, because like it's sort of close-ish to Hollywood, which is I think is where all the shenanigans with the exploding car went down. The scene with Kim and Tony, I feel bad for Tony in that situation where he's just trying, it's so,
also Kim's like, I don't know, maybe I'm just forgetting because we've been watching this for a little while, but I feel like Kim's paranoia, like extreme paranoia, is very convenient all of a sudden.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like I feel like she's been very naive up to this point, and then she's like switched to paranoia.
Yeah,
like it's, yeah. And you have also the stuff with Terry like not wanting to go to the hospital. Like I would assume, but like there's been no scene where she's actually been in trouble in a hospital, right? Like when she's known that she's in trouble, like she got kidnapped after with Kevin, but like that was already after like they had left the hospital. So yeah, like it just seems like a lot of these convenient devices so that she wouldn't go and get presumably picked off by the hitman that's driving around.
Yeah, it feels like the writers forgot what the audience knows versus what Kim knows,
yeah,
which is that they were actually in danger at the hospital, but they didn't know that. The only person who knew that was Nina and Jack, mm-hmm. right? Like the second mm-hmm. time they go to the hospital after they've been rescued.
Yeah,
And I mean, in a certain sense, if we had ever been, if it had ever been indicated that you know, Kim was someone who's quick on her feet or or worldly or had in any way shown any kind of curiosity about life around her, then I would absolutely buy that she's like, well, you know, where are they going to look for me? They're going to look for me at a hospital because they're going to assume I'm injured and that's how they'll find me. And if no one else knows that I'm missing, you know, except for the guy that's trying to kill me.
Yeah. And also, and also like her not going back to, well, I also can't tell if she's lying about, well, like, because she knows that Gaines is dead, presumably. So like, is it just like, just a feint so that she can get like she knows enough to know that that Gaines is dead, but she thinks that that Rick is still in contact with people, that like she thinks that Rick has like an actual idea of what's going on in this entire day so far.
I mean, she like, if she can take a taxi to Rick's, why can't she take a taxi to CTU, right?
Yeah. I mean, like, we had Nina rolling up in a taxi before also.
Yeah, so. She's going to roll right up to the back door. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just this awful contrived, you know, romance.
Yeah. Between. Like also the romance part, like you have Kim staying for like 5 minutes so that she can talk and then kiss Rick and then get entrapped by Dan's, even dumber brother.
Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, and this is the answer to why she's acting the way she does, is because, you know, she's love struck in this way. Uh-huh. But that's just so stupid.
It's even stupider that Rick is in this situation as well, like where he's fallen for this woman that, I mean, you know, as we've seen with Nash, attraction is a very, very strange thing, but
still,
we'll get to the Nash stuff also.
We've maybe belabored the Kim plot far too much. It's no good. It's bad.
It's no good. And we're going to see a drug deal go south again.
She's with them like the rest of the time, pretty much. Right?
Yeah. Like
until probably what, the final two episodes?
Probably, but I don't know. Like it will be very, very funny if Dan independently it also gets embroiled with the, or like Dan's brother gets embroiled with the Drazens.
That's another thing that's a little confusing too, is like, okay, so Dan and Rick were doing this for money that then apparently mm-hmm. they owe Dan's brother.
Well, like so that they can flip ecstasy.
Yeah. And Rick seems, you know, it's still, again, this goes back to the point of, like, why does Kim think Rick knows anything? Because Rick has made one mm-hmm. thing exceedingly clear this whole time, which is that he knows nothing. He's never been in on the planning. He's never been, no one's putting Rick in charge of anything. No one's telling Rick anything important. It's not happening.
And like, Kim saw Dan get a hole put in his head by Gaines. So, like,
yeah.
I would think that she would know that he didn't know that much.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like it's all very silly.
The Terry plot at least has some like novelty to it, like some soap opera kind of novelty, and the Kim plot just does not.
I mean, but it also like introduces like the idea of Terry getting immensely upset with Jack seeing Nina, even though she also went on some dates with this random surgeon guy. At a nice looking rustic restaurant.
Yeah, it's very Chez Panisse. I don't have anything smart to say about it other than that. Like, I mean, in some sense, I appreciate those scenes for, like you pointed out, they're sort of unintentionally Lynchian quality. But they seem so much about just spinning tires until we can get to the end, you know?
Yeah. Giving a couple of minutes so that Terry can first refuse and then have water.
Yes, yeah. There's so much stuff like that.
Yeah. I do appreciate the Tanya just piecing out.
Oh,
like that feels like actually like something that would happen.
Yeah. Yeah, smart move. Do we want to talk about like the big thing in episode 17?
Yes.
Yeah. Before we actually talk about it, this had my favorite quote from the episode, which is where Jack sort of yells, or semi-yells, you know, he's barking orders. He says, "I want SWAT personnel at the door, quietly." Which is just such an amazing, such an amazing, you know, microcosm of this show.
Yeah. I also love Jack explaining fiber optic cameras.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't had occasion to talk about tech as much since recently, the beginning of the show, but this is a great example.
Yeah, this also has, courtesy of Hopkins, of course, like one of my favorite shots in the show so far, which is of Jack and Nina looking, like they're looking at the cameras, or like, you know, like a array of monitors, but on the left side you have Alexis like standing on the, like on the leftmost side of the left monitor, and then on the right side, like aligned with Nina's point of view, like you have Nash looking at a, like looking, like standing at the right side of that monitor. Like it's like this really interesting like split screen effect that's like not actually a split screen.
Yeah, it's great because Hopkins is taking like the explicit kind of split screen framing that he does, and he's doing it like in the shot. He's doing Bazinian montage. That's what he's doing. He's doing montage in the shot.
Bazinian montage.
I don't know what your feelings are. I kind of think this sequence is aces. I mean, even if the writing part of it is sort of stupid, I think the way it's shot, I was into it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think this entire sequence, like, is it basically the entire Jack stretch minus maybe like the conversation he has with Nina, or the conversations, like just like the, you know, procedural part of it, like going right up until the stabbing, like it's all like really good, you know, like it plays the tension really well. Like you have her like putting the wallet in her jacket, like it's like that's sort of like a really great feint, and then it just goes south in this like extremely contrived way. Like, you
well,
know, obviously,
Ryan, women are just too fragile to handle these kinds of intense situations. National security. That's what the show is about.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the first of many, I think many times where a wronged woman will attack a terrorist.
Yeah,
out of nowhere.
It does become something of a trope in the show.
It's insane. this iteration especially is insane, especially because it's a letter opener. Like letter openers are not sharp enough to cut open a man's belly as far as I know. Especially
also,
a hotel letter opener.
You know, it's also just so stupid because I mean the way it's set up is that it does not seem to me that there is like an incredibly deep emotional relationship between these people.
Yeah.
And then with the added layer of the fact that like actually, you know, she has a very close relationship to the Palmer family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like there's just all these things pointing toward she can do this and she can handle it because, you know, she cares more about the people that she's gonna help protect. And I also just think like I think it forecloses a really interesting path the show could have taken where like the sequence is so suspensefully done, it's so great, and like so often the show is just like, you know, it reaches for the nearest letter opener or gun, and that's and that's how scenes get resolved. And like I get that that's kind of like the appeal of the show a little bit, but it's like you like some contrasting elements would be nice. Like if the sequence ended with, say, Drazen getting away or something, and they tracking him down, and it opens up a path in the show that's really interesting. That you know, then ends up with this insane, and then he gets the phone call, and it's from a guy who's never seen it. Yeah, it falls apart, but it was very good up until then.
I actually do like Jack just like immediately going with his scut and taking the phone call. Like that's some good Jack stuff.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, like I mean, like, you know, it's just like there's it's just like this very there's a specific intonation where Jack like says like I got her voicemail.
Yeah,
it's just like so mad. It's just like that. Like, you know, there's some fun stuff. And like I do think that Kara Zediker actually like plays like this episode well generally. Like and like she does like the sort of like where you're not quite sure how she's feeling like as Nina's briefing her. Like those stuff, like it works, but it's just like that. The resolution is just so easy, I guess, or like so like needlessly neat. I don't know, like it's like taking a path out that I don't like.
Yeah, I mean, everybody does the absolute most with the material that they can.
Yeah,
which is I think why it's so frustrating, because it can't overcome like the plot heavy writing, you know, where it's like, no, this next thing needs to get kicked in. And like, and I mean, there's certainly like a little bit of like a lurid or like tastefulness to just, you know, the blood and guts. But it's just so well done up to that point that, you know, it's a little bit of a letdown. But it's a well done sequence by everybody involved.
I did find it funny when Nina said, like, that wasn't smart. she was like, I don't know. Yeah, like, I kind of actually would have, it would have been cool to see, like, that entire sequence play, like, in split screen or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, like, it moves between them well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I also did, like, just, like, the sight of Jack with blood all over his shirt.
Oh, yeah. Like, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, like, He wears it well. I don't know. It's a strange thing to say, but he does wear it well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I did kind of hope that the safe phrase, I hope I'm not getting a cold, would be uttered again.
Oh yeah.
But no dice about that.
Yeah, that was a little disappointing.
Episode 18. I think this is like maybe the best Penny Johnson Gerald episode.
Oh yeah. I'm so glad you feel the same way. Yeah. I was loving it.
I mean, it's also especially funny because now that like seeing what a major role she has on the Orville, it's especially funny seeing her.
Oh man.
Seeing her
maneuver. Shout out to Carl as always. I think he's doing his best work right now.
It's
incredible.
It's, I mean, just like the switching the show names alone.
We also find out in this episode that Palmer is canon Dem.
Oh yeah. DNC. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that was something I knew about already.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I was somewhere between assumption and knowledge, like, but it just had struck me that it hadn't come up yet explicitly in so it's like, oh, I wonder how long they're gonna play the kind of like, this isn't really the real world, like these, it's not exactly the politics that you think it is. But
it would be a great bit, like making the first black president of Republican.
I would absolutely not put it past this show.
And yeah, that's, they should have gone for it.
And that's why I think it's been so long since I watched it that I was like, maybe, or maybe they'll like make up another party, you know. I just couldn't remember exactly how they resolved that. There's a moment where I think it's just that kind of phone conversation that Penny Johnson Gerald is having
yeah
before
it's so good
yeah so she's like she's like having this conversation, then she goes in and she's gonna like destroy the tape, and there's just this line where she's like, oh, the DNC will milk it.
Yeah.
And like, we don't know exactly what she's talking about, but it really captures the spirit of electoral politics.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, I did like note, I mean, of course it's a recurring sort of not problem, but like a recurring thing to like note about this, about all of Palmer's like plots, is that like she's talking about like the two most important things on this day for him. And it's like the primary and the family or something like that. And like, you can only focus on one. And it's like this, he's only been focusing on Keith and Ferragamo stuff for the entire time. And also like the assassination, but still like, it's like there's like this entire absence of like the primary stuff basically.
Yeah.
And like, so actually having like that sort of little moment where she's juggling like a conversation while she's also like looking at this immensely conspicuous mirror. But like, she plays it really well. Like, you know, it's like this sort of like very chatty, very friendly sort of thing while she's also like eyeing the, I couldn't tell if she actually knew the safe combination or not beforehand,
yeah.
But like, it was just like her like asking about the other callers' kids and things like that. Like, it's just really fun.
Yeah. And she quite accidentally, I think, utters what we might take as the kind of thesis statement of the whole show. When she's having this discussion earlier in the show that you're referencing, she says, "Today can't be about two things." Like, that's the spirit of 24 right there. No, it cannot be about two things. It can only be about one thing. Two things is too many to juggle. You start, you have two things and then three and four, and you start losing track.
Yeah. And that one thing is Jack Bauer.
Yes, exactly. Jack Bauer loves his family. That's what the show is about.
Yes. Yeah. I think there was also another good moment where Kim is talking with Rick, or like when they're like looking through Dan's stuff, and like Kim says something along the lines of like, oh, this is pointless or something.
Yeah.
Like
and then this also goes along with Mason when he says there's entirely too much personal business going on here.
That was such a that was an incredible, I mean, Mason gets like, as we said before, like these incredible moments, but like where he's just like facing down Tony and talking about how Nina's actually like, I think in that moment almost more is like seeding the possibility of Nina being a mole is where Nina's at the center of like all these sort of problems. I would say it's managed in a different context, but still, like, it's just funny watching Mason just like order Tony around.
Yeah.
Like that does seem like a typical day, like if Jack's not in the office and Mason's in charge, where he's just pushing Tony around.
Yeah, but like Jack does the same thing, like
oh, yeah,
in
totally.
A way they're like the same person. That's why they're so interesting to me, you know.
We also did get a mention of Milo.
We did. I noticed that.
Yeah,
he's still around somewhere.
Yeah,
we just won't see him for like five seasons.
It's great to think of Milo as just during like the next like 8 years, just hold up in the same server room. He's just off camera. I hope they mention Milo at least one or two more times during the next four seasons.
Yeah, I feel like after this season, I don't know, maybe we'll get a mention. I'm hoping for at least one more this season.
That was
gold, especially knowing how long it's going to be until he's back. And I like to think Mason just like gave him some busy work and then he just kept doing it for like 4 years. Like, hey, organize these like servers or something, and then he's just in a basement room. Okay. We got to talk about Teddy.
Oh, God.
What is going on? Why did you... Okay, I want to make sure it wasn't just... because I was watching it on Hulu this time. His dialogue sounds weird, right? Like, it's been overdubbed almost?
Well, I think it's just the guy. Like, he just
it's just the guy?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't notice anything, like, especially out of the ordinary. It's just, like, this guy, like, talking in this sort of, like, you know, gruff, or like, you know, like sort of gung-ho, like garbled sort of way.
When right? when Jack and Nina first walk up to him, it's this was, since you brought it up already, this was almost like a Lynchian moment. because there was like an uncanniness to the audio. Like it wasn't, it was off just enough that I was like, what? Like if it was delayed, it's as if it were delayed by like just his dialogue by like a couple of milliseconds, enough that like the sound and his mouth were like pretty much matched up, but not quite. And like it was mixed differently.
I just rewatched the moment you're talking about, and actually it is even more noticeable. Like okay. I think it's especially like it's especially noticeable because they're going up an escalator.
Yes, yeah. Like very, and he's just standing odd there. It's as if it was recorded in like a totally different space, and then they put it over top, and they were like just off, like just yeah. off. Because then when he's talking like over the radio, you don't, it doesn't seem as weird because you aren't really seeing him at the same time, and it like it's yeah. over like the comm.
Well, he just has this like very forward way, like this his body posture is like hunched forward, like he's about to like open his jaw and swallow you whole.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
it sort of like accents it. Like,
great jaw like, acting.
Yeah, like he opens his jaw before he's going to talk.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just like, yeah, I feel like for all the sort of disposable field agents we've had, like I feel like we haven't had nearly enough CTU just absolute meatheads, like the kind you probably like expect to find in a government agency.
Guys that were just a little smarter than cops, like just passed the CTU entrance exam on like their mm-hmm. third try.
Yeah.
I do like, although it's sort of ridiculous and pops up at a stupid time, I do like that there's like people who are antagonistic to Jack and not just mm-hmm. deferential to him, because I feel like he would be a controversial figure in the agency, and like this guy obviously has a very close personal connection, but
yeah,
I like that antagonism pops up a little bit.
I agree, but also I think it's just like in typical 24 fashion, it's taken like five steps too far.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. it's just really dumb, but also fun. Like, you know, like I definitely agree about that. Apparently, according to findings at CTU, Jack would later learn from the House Special Subcommittee that he was directly assigned to the mission by Alberta Green and Ryan Chappelle as a means of expressing their irritation at Bowers being reinstated at CTU. And after the events of the day, Hanlon was promoted.
Oh, jeez. I'm glad that you looked to the Bible for that.
Yeah.
Because I was sort of unsure how to read. Like, I didn't quite know if Mason was sincere about, uh-huh. like, it being out of his control that this dude was there, that TV yeah. was there. I like that it is, though. I like that, like, okay, these people went over his head specifically to annoy Jack, and they, like, totally blew the mission. And, like, no one is going to be held responsible for that. Like, again, it's like, okay, that's 24 getting back to its secret genre workplace mm-hmm. comedy. It's like, you know, you send a guy in that's the most annoying guy, and he mm-hmm. shoots someone off a bridge.
Yeah. The worst possible place for him to be shot off. Like right in front of this incredibly fragile glass.
It's so ridiculous.
Yeah. I know it's in downtown, I think, so it's not Hollywood and Highland, and Hollywood and Highland doesn't have like that big fountain, but it did remind me of that place a lot, which is where like where the Oscars are held. It's just like the funniest possible place for a Oscar ceremony to be held, like in a shopping mall that's right next to a Ripley's, Believe It or Not, and a McDonald's.
Like, yeah, there's
it's
a
really
reason
funny
they
watching the Oscars. Yeah, like the red carpet, just like seeing like this dinosaur in the background.
Yeah, I you know, there's a reason they don't show us a lot of wide shots, right? Like,
yeah,
the frame is very tightly controlling what the image of like what's yeah. going on there is.
Yeah, apparently the restaurant that they're outside in this episode is a Panda Express. So.
I love okay, two things I do love about this sequence, mm-hmm. which is just kind of dumb, but in a fun way, I guess. I love the yellow umbrellas. And I love Jack just like in before things kick into gear, just like standing around.
Yeah,
like there's some interesting framings, and we have a new director on this on this episode to Frederick King Keller, who just seems
his middle name is King?
Yeah, that's what his credit is. I think that's his middle name, yeah. He just seems to be like a TV guy, you know.
Yeah.
Has done a lot of that. But so we get those.
He also directed a Tuck Everlasting.
Yeah, but it's like an old one. It's not
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And he was a producer on the documentary from a couple years ago about the director Larry Cohen.
Oh, really?
I have no idea why he was. There's not a lot about him. I mean, he really seems like a guy that does this as his job. Like, he's not. he's just seems perfectly content to do TV.
Oh yeah, sure.
But we do get a cool shot with the yellow umbrellas, and then the guy that Jack's meeting up with is in that like red hat. That's like Harry Dean Stanton in Texas.
He has a bit of a Harry Dean aspect him also.
He does. It was great.
Yeah, like when they said red hat, I didn't think it'd be like bright red like that.
I know. I was thinking like, you know, maybe like a Red Sox hat or something.
Yeah.
They told the prop people we need a red hat, and the prop people said, boy, do we have a red hat.
Yeah. Also just like, well, like a, like you said, Jack, just like roaming around, like strolling around for like in real time must have been like 15 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. Just with this big a very weird stainless steel briefcase. Yeah.
And then also his absolute irritation at these kids playing with water guns.
Yeah, Jack definitely strikes me as a dad that was like, you know, when the fun's over, it's over, right? Like,
oh yeah,
maybe that's why Kim is so joyless.
Well, we need to start charting the 24 characters on the McDonald's triangle.
Jack is 100% we have McDonald's at home.
Well, either that, like, yeah, I guess he's probably not impish enough to go for like the black coffee thing. I feel like he would probably
that's
down
George Mason.
Oh yeah.
That's their difference. That's their key difference.
Yeah.
And Tony has taken the kids to McDonald's.
Oh yeah, totally. he's getting the McDonald's, but he's also getting the black coffee in his Cubs mug.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. He's like, could you just put it in here?
Yeah, I do like Jack effortlessly getting the information out of this random electrician guy. He's just like so skillful in it, like he just moves on. Like the only thing that gives him away is this accent. I would have also liked to have heard Jack attempt a Serbian accent.
I was a little disappointed that he didn't like on the phone think, oh, Drazen had an accent.
Yeah.
Well, he does blow it a little bit too by asking. So he asks like, what are you going to do for me? And the guy tells him, and then he asks him, what else? And that's where the guy, and it's like, ah, oh, Jack,
it was a little bit much, but I feel like, I don't know, it might have tipped him off to realize that he didn't have the accent, but you know, like it was probably good just to get the information. But...
Yeah, yeah. I feel like he could have come up with an excuse, you know, like, hey, I'm in public, you know, I don't want to draw attention to myself, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. Also, I don't think we actually, I guess we actually did see Jack's house, like, exterior before, but, like, in this second one, like, in this episode, like, it looks really nice, like, nicer than we had seen before.
Yeah, well, and it was, you know, it was so dark at the beginning of the show
that
I just didn't have, like, a good sense of the outdoor space of the
house. I guess apparently, like, they filmed it, I guess this is just, like, filming location, so it might just be the inside, but, yeah, the outside is, like, it has, like, this entire, like, sort of lavish front yard.
Yeah.
And, like, and then when Rick, like... I think it was Rick, like, talking about Kim coming from money or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I didn't really believe it before, but, like, looking at Jack's house, like, it is really nice.
Yeah, it's nice. He's got a nice pad.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly where it is, but it's just surprisingly. Oh, okay. According to, Well, like, apparently they moved around a lot, but yeah. So I don't know. Like it just looks kind of. It was just kind of surprising, like seeing, especially seeing the assassin guy just hiding behind a tree.
Yeah.
And then taking out another CTU agent.
And just a body on the ground. Yeah. He's, you know, in defense of this guy did not think he was going into an active situation.
But oh, no.
They really should prepare these agents better, you know?
Yeah.
It's no wonder that these guys are like skimming money off the top, because they have like a 10% survival rate. Like, I'd be taking money too.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have I also did like the scene where like Andre was like cool as a cucumber while this assassin guy was freaking out. Like, he still was like, I couldn't tell if he had actually seen that the car went over or if he was just like still pulled over on that same part of like the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But yeah, like, we're still weirdly 6 episodes from the end. We're still in this like very sort of like indefinite amorphous space, I think.
Yeah, they're really kind of stretching it out.
Yeah.
But I will say, I mean, I know we already talked about it a little bit, but really the scene between the Palmers, the kind of switcheroo that gets pulled on the tape, that's like such a great scene. And it's something this show doesn't very often do well, which is like, here, this is like totally a scene where the drama and the intrigue is coming a lot from these like evolving personal interrelationships, right?
Right.
And like, man... both Haysbert and Penny Johnson-Gerald just bring their A game. It's like such a great like mano-a-mano scene.
Yeah, and you don't get the sort of expected thing of Palmer like yelling or something like that.
Yeah.
It's just like him just like processing it all and like just like, you know, slowly revealing it and like talking about like how he had to be sure of it. Like, it's just like this great gambit. I also really like the scene with Mike earlier on, where he suggests using as almost blackmail or something like that against the cabal, it's just like these really interesting like twists on characters.
Yeah,
like it makes sense at that point that Mike's pragmatism would lead him to using it for that purpose.
Yeah, Mike is so great in that scene because it's like, yeah, like you said, he's so good at what he does because he's just a ruthless pragmatist, right? He's like, well, okay, we have this now, but we can use it for this. And also kind of like, it's also a way to like get Palmer to like drop it without feeling like he's dropping it, you know, as if you have like an ace in the hole, you know?
Yeah.
I surprisingly, this story, you know, the whole key thing that has been stretched out now for 18 episodes is like, is actually doing some really interesting stuff at this point.
Yeah,
just because it's hung around so long.
Yeah.
Unlike the Terry Kim stuff, which is again like, it just feels like repeating the same motions over and over.
Yeah.
The Palmer stuff is really clicking into place.
Yeah, and you have Terry about to be in trouble again in this same way. I mean, it'll be funny to see what happens to the surgeon.
Oh, this guy's dead, right? I mean, he's dead.
Yeah, I mean, like, I do think about the John Boyce statistic of like 40% of the named characters dying. It's like, yeah, this guy's probably going into 40%.
That's rough. That's so rough. Like, you're getting a 24 script and you're an actor and it's basically a coin toss whether you'll make it through the episode if your name isn't Jack.
Yeah, but you could also get the privilege of wearing Jack Bauer's bloody shirt.
Yes. Yeah. The shirt switch is so good. Yeah. I hope whoever that extra was took that shirt home with them.
Yeah.
You know, shoved it into his like bag or something.
These episodes, I mean, they're not like bad, but like, just it's just getting more and more heightened, the difference in quality between the different disparate strands.
Yeah.
Just because, like, you know, some feel momentum driven, like while incorporating some good moments, but also like, this is not also the others are not working, just on the face of it.
Yeah, and I'm really interested as we go forward to see how whether or not this peculiar situation gets replicated, because I think so much of this results from the show really being written for 13 episodes.
Totally.
And then it's like, oh, we have to somehow, you know, loop this all back together. And it makes sense. I mean, I can see from a writing perspective why you would say, well, I don't want too many seasons in one. I want to like make these arcs and these tensions that we've been, that we've had, I want to make them continue to resonate. But it's just so hard to get from this moment of resolution back to something, you know, that's exciting. It's like, it's kind of like, you know, you're kind of seeing how the sausage is made in real time, and it's like not very pretty most of
the time. Yeah. I did also realize that, like, just one of the, like, maybe the key reason why they just really haven't focused on Palmer's actual primary stuff is that, like, even at the start, like, it seemed pretty, like, the beginning of the series, it seemed pretty preordained that he would win Super Tuesday. So, like, it was more like, just trying to keep him alive. So that doesn't really give him a lot to do.
Well, and it's also
tour,
like
tour high schools and power plants.
Well, and weirdly, despite the fact that it's primary day, it's actually like the least important day because you've already done what you can do.
Yeah.
Like the reason nothing is going on there is because everybody's still voting. Like the polls still don't close in the show for two more episodes.
Yeah.
Like then the primary becomes important again because you start to see results come in and stuff like that. But until then, it's like, what are these people supposed to do? Like, what's the point of campaigning? Like the campaign, you know, for California anyways, is like over. Like you're here, but you know, you're not going to go out today and convince a bunch more people to vote. Like it's voting day. Yeah, so but that'll be interesting. I'm interested to see what that looks like in a couple episodes, because you know, you almost forget about it sometimes.
Yeah, it would be great if they just suddenly switched to pure like just watching the exit polls, like Jack's driving around trying to deal with terrorists, and he's also listening.
It's on his radio. Yeah. Is there like a big like talk radio station in LA?
No, not really.
Okay.
No, I don't know. What if Jack was a huge NPR listener?
Oh, that, you know what? That's exactly the kind of bullshit this writer's room would pull. That's exactly what they would do. That exemplifies the spirit of the show right there. Jack cruising around, you know, with his gun on the passenger seat, listening to Terry Gross.
I don't think there was really much else.
Yeah, I don't have anything else.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just thinking again about the sheer idiocy of Kim staying like just long enough so that Dan's brother can roll up.
And it's like there's no way she can like slip out or anything. I mean, I guess the guy would be mad at Rick, but you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, he was going to be mad at him regardless because, like, it's pretty clear
that... Yeah, this is not going to go well for Rick.
Yeah.
Rick's toast.
Yeah. I mean, it's... Did he not try to sneak out beforehand? Like, because he knew that this guy was coming. Like,
yeah,
was he
I mean,
just going to stick around and, like, let his... And, like, take the blame instead of his girlfriend or something like that? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great point, which is, like, what is Rick even doing here if he knows that this is coming down?
Yeah,
but as I said, you know, smart is not the descriptor that I would.
I mean, yeah, like I get it. You got to do some things, like even though you're on probation. But do you have to go out of your way to effectively kidnap these girls for half a day? It's
yeah. He really goofed it up.
Yeah, the writers' room goofed it up here too. I also do really like the scene where Palmer and Keith are talking, and then he talks about like the burden he's been having for all this time.
Oh yeah,
like, that's really good. Like,
yeah,
you just and like it looks like I presume it's like grapefruit juice or something like that. But it almost looks like Palmer has a Negroni on, like, it's my favorite cocktail, so I really appreciated that.
Oh, that's great. No, it's definitely a Negroni. We've seen him drink quite a bit.
Yeah, I guess
like a surprising amount.
Yeah, that's true. We haven't seen it really play out.
No, he's the kind of guy who can drink whenever he wants, and he's just always stone cold
sober. Oh, totally. Alexis would totally be a vodka drinker.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. it's so wild that they just, that was the path they took with him, just like taking him out of commission. It's just so funny. These episodes are very funny, if infuriating, but we're learning more and more to just take it as it goes.
Yeah, I think we're doing a good job of simulating the experience of, you know, watching 24 in 2002. Yes.
Yeah, we had the John Boyce tweet. Like, he said specifically for season 8, yeah, that season 8 is on the podium of dumbest TV seasons. The rest of the podium is other 24 seasons.
this is because he and Matt Chrisman were singing the praises of Stephen Root, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Stephen Root. I can't wait for Stephen Root. He's not even in that many episodes in season 8.
Yeah, I completely forgot. I mean, I didn't really know Stephen Root then, but I completely forgot that he was on it. I mean,
I'm excited for later seasons when we get more casting like that.
Yeah, we're gonna get we're gonna get some really interesting casting very, very soon. Also, oh yeah, that I'm excited for your reaction to.
I can't wait because I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh yeah,
but I'm hyped.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not in the character actor sort of way. I guess maybe you could say that, but we'll see.
Well, you know, 24 does great stunt casting and character actor casting.
So, oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
Penny Johnson-Gerald for one.
Oh man, MVP. Yeah.
MVP for
honestly.
Yeah, after Gaines after Gaines' departure, like she's probably assumed that same sort of position.
Yeah. What a pro.
Her and Mason really.
Yeah, her and Mason for sure. Yeah, both just consummate pros.
Yeah, it's also funny like hearing about Mason talking about like too much personal business when he and Sarah Clark met and married because of 24.
That's so great.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a, I don't know, no more quotes, right?
No, I'm plumb out. I used them all.
Yeah. I guess we'll see how much further down the rabbit hole that Terry goes. If she isn't like immediately triggered out of her amnesia by the sight of a gun, which, you know,
it's gonna be something exactly like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll probably be better. It'd be also funny if it ended with her still in amnesia mode, like if she
went out still in amnesia. Oh no.
I don't know if that would make it like more or less tragic or more or less funnier. It's
just like definitely more funny.
More funny, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, the show needs to get more funny.
Yeah, absolutely. It needs to get more intentionally funny, we should say.
I think the unintentional stuff works pretty well.
Oh yeah, totally. but yes, please join us then to further discover these pathways.
We'll see you next time.